This is Pure Decking for Thursday. What the hell is today? August the 29th, 1976. It's a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Big Brother and Suave Potato. I'm drinking Newcastle. What you got, Suave? What you got your hands on? Suave, you're muted.
I am drinking a brand of beer that I care not to mention on the air.
Ooh, hipster. That sounded strangely domestic.
Oh, it's extremely domestic.
Fair enough. Big, you back?
He'll be back.
He'll be back. He went to go get whatever it is he's drinking. And, well, we'll just ask him when he gets back what he's drinking, because it's like, okay, let's start. I'll be right back. Well, fuck. So, I think everyone's pretty much made it back to their native areas, with the exception of RU. We're all mostly recovered from Gen Con. Well, mostly. Some of us more than others.
You know, this plague keeps creeping up on me again. I keep thinking I'm over it, and then I'll just get racked by coughs for another couple of days.
Well, I think, in my case, I sometimes get hay fever.
Okay.
Some years I get it, some years I don't. It's kind of strange. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, into summer crud and all, if, you know, I got this little minor cold at Gen Con, and it just kind of triggered. You know, because it kind of feels like allergies just hanging around now. So, that or, you know, it's the next fucking incarnation of the bird flu. Thanks, Suave.
Hey, I always do my part.
So, anyways, I'm still just stalling to see if Big's going to make it back in town before we start talking. Because I know he'd have an opinion on the discussion topic, too, here.
What?
There he is. Big, what are you drinking, man?
Iced tea.
Long Island iced tea?
Nope.
Looks like we got That's a badass sweet. Over here.
I'm a badass. After nearly dying, my experience with alcohol is kind of limited now.
I don't blame you.
Fair ball, man. Fair ball.
We did almost kill you.
It's true.
Well, that was a lot of whiskey, though. We had a lot of whiskey at the meetup.
Yeah.
And, it was
and
like,
we
what?
All needed it.
It was like, what, 2 in the morning to 2 at night?
Yeah, give or take. So, well, we downed that entire bottle of Woodford's I brought. We downed most of what Fox had with him, that scotch he had with him.
That was good.
We downed about half a Madman's bottle.
Probably about a quarter of that bottle I brought, but...
Yeah.
And then nobody touched it for the rest of the meetup. I'm sure the housekeeping staff were very happy for the large amount of alcohol.
Who was it that had that huge bottle of Jim Beam? Was that what you had?
Yeah, that's what I brought.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was like $20 at like Walmart or something. And it was like,
well, I'm just
blows my mind.
I know. Well, you know, if I were to buy that in Canada, $60 minimum.
Damn, really?
So, yeah. So, but you know, I saw that for $20. I'm like, ooh, I must have this much alcohol.
So say we're not that far from where they make it in Indies. I mean, I'm closer now, but Indies not really that far from where they make it. So I don't bat an eye at like $20 for a big old thing of Jim Beam. Of course, it's Jim Beam, but you know, compared to everything else we had there, I mean,
yeah, like, you know, Jim Beam is decent.
It's not a bad whiskey. I'll drink it. I drink it regularly, but it's not.
It was garbage compared to what everybody else brought.
Well, everybody else brought the really good stuff, and Jim Beam is just kind of your regular, you know, it's a good drinking whiskey, but, I mean, I don't know. Anyways, let's go ahead and move on. I'm nearing that time where it's time to rebuild all of my Windows machines. They're starting to get a little bit janky on me, you know. It happens. By a year, year and a half in, you about time to rebuild your Windows box.
Yeah, I try to do it every year.
Yeah.
I need to do the same.
Yeah, it happens. And 7's gotten a lot better about than XP. And I honestly don't know on 8 because I've been avoiding it because it's such a freaking goofy interface on it.
It's like learning the OS all over again, and it's worse. You can't do as much, it seems like. Yeah, I'm sure all the features are there. They're just hidden.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's the core of Windows 7. It's the same damn OS. It's just this goofy iPad Envy interface on it. I don't know.
Really? As long as you switch the desktop mode and avoid the magic corners, because that's fucking stupid. It's really the same. I only use the search bar in other versions of Windows, or the home button, whatever the hell it is, for the search option anyway.
You know, what really got to me, I can't remember who had it, but somebody had a Windows 8 tablet.
Laser had it.
Yeah, Laser had a Windows 8 tablet. I was playing around with it, but, you know, it seems like there's a ton of stuff that you can't do on it when just using the touch interface.
Oh, yeah, no, like, he had to keep going back to his keyboard and mouse.
Yeah, exactly, because like, you actually couldn't actually access a lot of the stuff that you need to access just using touch.
The keyboard is missing buttons.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't get on the command line and type stuff out because it didn't have things.
Yeah.
So
it's just fundamentally broken. You know, give them, wait till they come out with, like, you know, 8.1 or maybe, like, Windows 9 or whatever the hell they're going to call it. And it'll probably be good. It's kind of like the whole Vista fiasco where, you know, Windows 7 is essentially Windows Vista. It's just they fixed all the problems.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to do the same thing with Windows 8. You know, it's going to be Windows 8.5 or it's going to be Windows 9.
They fired Ballmer.
Yeah.
Keeping him out.
Although, from what I understand, it's not so much about the whole Windows tablet thing. It's more about him completely reorganizing the company structure and instituting some horrible, horrible internal policies that are just killing like company morale, and it was just really not working for people.
Yeah. He's made a ton of my understanding was it was the whole announcing they lost like $900 billion thanks to Windows 8 and Windows RT and all the tablets and shit.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The whole thing's a mess, and we'll see where it ends up. But with all the bullshit going on with Windows, I'm going to try my hand at moving over to Linux as my main OS again. Now, I've tried to do this a couple of times before, and you know, you'll go hardcore Linux, and then you end up dual booting to play a game, and then you end up not booting back into Linux very often just because it's more convenient to stay in Windows because, you know, usually it's wanting to play a game with people, and you know, that's what I do with my home machines. They're entertainment machines. My work machines, well, I do work on them, and I have enough machines now, or computers now, that I actually segregate what I'm doing to different machines.
Racist.
So, yeah. Sure, why not? I've got a Southern enough accent. Why not? The thing is, though, like, my work-issue laptop, that's where I do a lot of my, well, work now. Like, a lot of my security stuff happens on that machine, because that's where all the tools are. And so my personal home machines are mostly entertainment and audio work and, you know, stuff for the station. And I'm figuring out, just kind of Googling around and looking at it, that most of what I want to do, I can probably do, with the exception of games, on a Linux desktop and just sidestep all of this Windows goofiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last time I took a serious look at running Linux as my main OS, they were just made the jump to Unity and GNOME 3, and the desktop managers were all a fucking mess. So it's like, well, just wait. Well, I feel like I've waited long enough. So, but this is the first time I've tried to go Linux full time, and not because I'm pissed at Windows. Like, usually it's because I've gotten some malware or something's pissed me off, and it's like, fuck it, I'm going to Linux. I'm like, no, this time I'm actually looking at it and trying to make a reasoned decision that this might be an easier way to go about things. So, I don't know. Have you guys looked at doing Linux full-time, pretty much?
You know, I continuously consider it, but I just... Most of the software I like is, like, you know, Windows only. And, of course, I can do it through Wine, everything like that. And I guess it really comes down to me. I don't have a lot of experience with Linux. So it's really just a matter of, like, relearning an OS.
Gotcha.
And, you know, I've taken the dive once before, and I had so many problems with the audio that I gave up. But of course, this is like 5 or 6 years ago. So, you know, I'm sure it's a lot better now.
Well, that's about the time they switched over to Pulse Audio as a main backend on like everything. Yeah. And that
actually
just broke so much.
When I switched over to Linux, it was pretty much the exact date when they started using Pulse Audio, and nothing worked. And I just got so frustrated that I just gave up on it.
That's funny, because Pulse Audio is pretty much what drove me off of Linux as my main OS for a long time.
Right.
I used Linux as my main OS for about a year, some of the earlier Ubuntu builds. Mm-hmm. And they switched it over to Pulse, and it just broke so much. Go ahead, Big.
I'm just agreeing with you guys. Pulse fucking sucked. I'm sure they had their reasons. I mean, Ulsa's getting on up there. They've got to replace it with something newer and fancier and shinier, but they needed to make sure they had backwards compatibility. They just broke so much shit.
But it's really funny, too. When you go back and look at the mailing lists, the Pulse guys are blaming all the desktop environments and the app developers, particularly Ubuntu. They said the Pulse guys said Ubuntu implemented it totally wrong. Ubuntu, of course, was blaming all the application guys for not catching up in time. And everybody else was, of course, just flat out blaming Pulse.
Right.
So the whole thing was just a clusterfuck. Oh, 11 minutes in. Cursed. Yep. So, I don't know, but here lately it looks like a lot of that stuff's gotten cleaned up and is kind of standardized out. So, I don't know. I mean, what you post here, Big. Linux audio mess.
Yep.
Oh, this ought to be good.
It's just a big web of all the different libraries and the different audio engines and how they interact with each other. Just Google it. Linux audio mess. It's a clusterfuck.
I like the phone on into G streamer.
Yep.
That's not right. Phone on is, if I'm remembering right, phone on's the KDE answer to G streamer. But they've got it. Oh, maybe they mean. Maybe this picture means that could be switched out. I don't know. It kind of looks funny. But and Blue Z, yeah, they got all kinds of crazy stuff on there. So, I don't know. It looks like a lot of that mess has gotten cleaned up, though. So, we're going to give it another shot.
Yeah, you know, I've been seriously considering switching back over to Linux here. It's been long enough. I'm sure all the audio issues have been cleared up. And you know, like Morps was telling me here that Wine is working way better than it used to, and for running just about anything.
Oh yeah. Well, that was actually one of the points I got down the line here. Pretty much the only thing I know of that I can't do in Linux as good as or better than what I'm doing in Windows now, especially for station stuff, you know, some of my programming stuff, is games. That's the only thing at this point holding me back. So what I'm planning on doing is I'm going to keep my big red laptop running Windows for Tractor and LAN party games. And I'm going to take my main rig over to probably Linux Mint, maybe Arch. The only problem I have with Arch is that it takes forever to set up, but I really like it once you get it set up. So I'm probably just going to go ahead and go to Linux Mint.
All right, this is a stupid question. I don't know much about Arch, but from what I hear, it's the new Gentoo. Is that true?
Oh, wow. kettle of a whole bunch of shit there. Gentoo.
Oh, I know. Explain it.
Okay. The big thing with Gentoo was that everything on the system was compiled from source on your system. So if you knew what you were doing with GCC and the configuration flags, you could make a seriously optimized system. And it's, if you really want to understand how Linux works, it's worth doing a stage one Gentoo install sometime. I mean, you know, do it in a VM these days. For God's sake, don't do it on a real machine anymore. But, I mean, just because the first time you do it, you're going to mess stuff up. You're going to want snapshotting. It takes forever to do it. It's not nearly as bad as it used to be. The first time I built a Gen 2 system, it was on a Pentium 3 running at 700 megahertz with an ATI graphics card, and it took a week before I had a functioning desktop.
Wow.
And then a month later, I had to format the thing back to Windows for software I needed for school. So,
awesome.
Anyways, yeah, I mean, it's Gen 2 is a massive pain in the butt, but my God, does the system fly when you set it up with that.
Oh, I bet.
Now, but the thing with Gen 2 is it doesn't have a default. It drops you on a command line and says, okay, install the desktop environment you want. Install the software you want. It's you know, a stage one Gen 2, and so when you're done, you have a command prompt. I mean, so, and Arch is kind of the same way in that you don't get this massive collection of pre-installed software. Like most of your common Linux distros, you boot it up, you get a desktop, it's got all the software you want on it. You know, it's got GIMP, it's got a web browser, it's got a desktop. Arch and Gen 2 don't have that. They expect you to configure all that on your own, you know, the way you want it. You know, they're really meant for system tweakers. Arch, though, doesn't build the packages on your system. They still use pre-compiled packages. And the funny thing is people will do different speed comparisons. A lot of them say Arch is just as fast as Gen 2. So a lot of it comes down to probably not having a whole bunch of software you're not using loaded into the system, really, for the speed gains. But Arch is a very clean system. It's fantastic for servers. As far as desktops go, it's just a time thing, really. It is a little bit more complex to get things up and going with Arch, but thanks to HAL, not anything like what it used to be. Writing your own xorg.conf really fucking sucks. But these days, you don't even need that, so the system's auto configure anymore. So they're not too bad, but the only reason I'd go with Linux Mint is just, you know, time saver, have a functioning desktop and not have to spend a couple of days getting everything configured and tweaked. So like I said, I'm not going to take every machine I have over to Linux. I'm going to keep a Windows box just for quick little things where it's easier to do it.
But I'm
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I did recently switch my... I got an old Acer Aspire 1. And I swapped that over to Crunchbang Linux. And I got to say, I'm very impressed with that distro. It's a very, very clean interface. Really enjoying it. It's kind of revitalized that old school laptop.
Oh, yeah. It will, definitely. I just in my notes had some rundowns of some of this stuff when I was thinking about it. Audio software wise, I'm way more interested in the Linux side of things now that I've actually started looking at it and understanding the paradigm. Because on the Windows side, everything, of course, has to be done through Osseo, and you usually have to have a fairly beefy audio interface, and everything's done through VSTs. Well, on Linux, it's all done through Jack, and everything's kind of its own little program. So it doesn't really matter if you got the right format for this or if it supports that. It's all kind of routed through Jack audio-wise. And my favorite DAW right now, Renoise, has a native Linux build that supports Jack. So, and you can do a hell of a lot more with the Jack audio kit than anything on Windows I've seen. The closest I've seen that something comes to it is the Rewire stuff, but I don't think it really holds a candle to the way you can route audio around in Jack. Not to mention all the software is free versus, $500, $1,000 for, some of the audio software that's floating around out there.
Free is nice.
Free is very nice. So, the audio stuff, of course, Audacity is open source. There's plenty of Audacity stuff. All the basic stuff I use on, everyday TeamSpeak, web browser, Skype, all that stuff. Of course, there's plenty of Linux builds for that. So that's not even an issue. Games is really the only hang-up. So I was trying to think, how would I solve that if my main rig is running Linux? And, of course, multiple systems is a quick, easy solution. just, you know, grab the Windows machine if you need to do something with Windows, right? But, you know, there's also dual booting, which is something I've done for a very long time. And because I like leaving my systems either on or asleep, it's kind of tedious to switch operating systems. So you got to shut down, select the right one, come back up. So, you know, when somebody says, hey, let's all go hop into Payday and I'm in the wrong OS, well, you know, I need 5 minutes to go switch operating systems here. So that can be kind of a, that can be kind of a thing. Plus two, generally what ended up happening to me when I was dual booting is I would end up booting into Windows to do something and leaving the system in Windows and end up, you know, even though I've got Linux on there, only booting into it maybe, you know, 25% of the time. Not for any failing in Linux, just because it was a hassle to switch back over, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you've got one thing going for you. Steam is pushing a lot harder for the Linux gaming, and they're pushing a lot of their games to the Linux side as well.
Yes,
they
are.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, so. You know, probably give it another 5 years or so, and you're probably going to see, like, a large percentage of the Steam games are going to be Linux compatible. Like, right now, it's not a huge library. What is it, like 20 games or something? That it's not a lot, but...
But they got their Source engine running, so everything on that.
Yeah,
I don't think you're going to be waiting 5 years, because aren't they still making a console?
Maybe.
I think that's Linux-based.
It's true.
But that was always my theory about why Steam was doing a Linux version, was to they could just have the code ready to port over to a console.
And, you know, that'd be great. You know, the second they come out with the Linux-based console, it's going to be game over for Windows-based games. Like, it's really, like, Steam is the forerunner for the PC master race of gaming.
So that's, you know, of course, the just Linux native stuff through Steam is always an option. Virtual machines are an option. I do have a couple of Windows applications that are going to get wrapped up in VMs just for ease of use. And, you know, I do a lot of server work, and wrapping up Windows in a virtual machine is so much nicer than running it on bare metal. Snapshotting, you know, the hardware abstraction. I've always found my Windows virtual machines run a hell of a lot better than, you know, with the exception, again, of you know, 3D performance, just as far as system stability and, you know, automated backups via snapshots. I don't know about you guys, but managing Windows is a hell of a lot easier in a virtual machine.
It really is.
So, but there is for games, there is some work being done. VirtualBox has a Direct3D wrapper that you can install. You have to install their version of the VM tools. And apparently the performance on that's not bad. I haven't tried it in a long time, but I'm going to.
Right.
So every example I've seen of it is always running an older game, not anything new. So I don't know how good of a translation it is. But
actually, I just looked it up here. Steam has currently got about 238 games for Linux.
It's not bad.
168 of which, 169 have been confirmed to be working. So I'm guessing just people haven't played the other ones, or I don't know what the deal is.
I just haven't reported.
Yeah.
So,
that's decent.
Yeah, it's not bad. So, and then of course there's Wine, which Wine has come a hell of a long way. It's always been around, but it was always kind of a joke as to whether something would work in it or not. But I just, when I was exploring this idea earlier today, I went and there's people who posted YouTube videos of the brand new Payday game running in Wine without a hiccup.
Oh,
nice.
So, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much sold on it at that point. It's like, you know, I mean, my Linux servers always last a hell of a lot longer than my Windows boxes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hardware-wise as well. I mean, hell, look at the broadcast box. How many Windows-based broadcast boxes have I had go down? The only time I've killed the Linux broadcast box is because you guys threatened to lynch me if I didn't.
No, not me.
And technically, the current broadcast box is living on Linux. It's just got a VM wrapper around it.
Right.
So, you know, know, I mean, I'm just applying all my server experience here, but I'm just kind of tired of fighting with it. And it's like, well, I'm thinking Linux honestly looks like an easier way to go at this point.
Yeah.
So.
Not and I know free. Lord lives on.
Huh?
Can't oh, be free.
Yeah.
No, you cannot be free. Plus, too, I know that Lore lives on Linux Mint, so, you know. If I go Mint full-time, that'll make him happy, because he can ask me stuff. Not that it's that different from running a Debian server in the first place, but hey, you know, whatever. So, anyways, I don't know. You guys got any final thoughts before we go into the news here?
No. Linux, good. Free, awesome.
Well, I'm going to format my box Saturday. Oh, geez, right before IHN.
Oh, well, no.
I'll probably have it working. If not, well, we might have to get somebody else to read the disclaimer. So,
hopefully Anthony will be on.
Yeah. I don't think it'd be that big of a deal.
He's got a sexy voice.
He does.
Anyways, so let's see. First story up I have is from Ars Technica, but this is actually all over the place. A major new patent bill passed in a 117-4 vote by New Zealand's parliament, and those four guys are probably going to get shot. After 5 years of debate, has banned software patents, which I think is fantastic because I don't know how you patent software. I know how you copyright software. I think that's the actual appropriate thing. But how the fuck do you patent a scroll bar? I mean,
oh yeah, well, it, you know, it's like saying that you patented a piece of artwork or you patented a song. Like that, it just doesn't work like that.
You don't invent code. You write code.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Like,
I don't.
90% of the time, the code that you're using is based off of some other code somewhere else. You know, like
all modern programming is mostly tying libraries together and putting the glue code and the math in.
Yeah.
So, exactly. I mean, that's for the most part. I mean, I guess if you're sitting in assembler, that's not quite true. But if you're writing Android apps or Java, that's that's the majority of what you're doing is just making library calls to draw crap, and then of course you put your own code in for the math and the logic of it. So. Anyways, back to the story here. The relevant clause of the patent bill actually states that a computer program is not an invention. Some have suggested that it was a way to get around the working of the TRIPS intellectual property treaty, which requires patents to be available for any inventions, whether products or processes in all fields and technology. Processes will still be patentable if the computer program is merely a way of implementing a patentable process, but patent claims that cover computer programs as such will not be allowed. So what they're saying there is if you've got this super secret sauce and you figured out a way to do it on a computer as opposed to guys with widgets and, you know, screwdrivers, that you can still patent the process. But you're not patenting the computer program on its own, which means you're not patenting, you know, scroll bars. It seems that there may be some leeway for computer programs directly tied to improved hardware. The bill includes an example for a better washing machine. Even if the improvements are implemented with a computer program, the actual contribution is a new and improved way of operating a washing machine that gets clothes cleaner and uses less electricity, so a patent could be awarded. So they haven't completely nixed them, but what they're doing is they're getting away from some of the most retarded ones. So it's a good example, if nothing else. One member of parliament who was deeply involved in the debate, Claire Curran, C-U-R-R-A-N, I don't mean to mispronounce that, I just drink, quoted several heads of software firms complaining about how the patenting process allowed obvious things to get patented and that in general software patents are counterproductive. Curran quoted one developer as saying, "It's near impossible for software to be developed without breaching some of the hundreds of thousands of patents granted around the world for obvious work. These are the heavyweights of the new economy in software development," said Curran. "These are the people that need to be listened to, and thankfully they were." The head of New Zealand's Institute of IT Professionals, Paul Matthews, celebrated the passage of the bill, tweeting, "Software patents are now disallowed in New Zealand." #historic. Why are they putting those in there? God.
Twitter,
yay. Matthews also noted that the new law will only apply to new patent applications, so existing patents will still continue to stand in New Zealand. Yay. That's pretty much the relevant part of the article there. New Zealand has effectively banned new software patents, which is cool, but it doesn't exactly solve the problem of all the existing ones out there that need to be struck down.
Yeah.
All well, right.
Hopefully, but what's going to happen is, as these patents on these software expires, they won't have a way to renew it, because it's now illegal, right? Or are they just permanently retroactively immune from this?
No, that you're right. Patents do expire, but, you know, I'm waiting a little over a decade for that.
Yeah.
But it is 11 years, or is it? I forget.
I think it's a decade.
It's a decade? Okay. I thought it was about 11 years that the patent was good for.
So it's not the best option, but hell, it's more than we've got before.
That's true. Actually, there was a big hubbub in 3D printing a little while back about one of the software patents on 3D printing expiring.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting watching all the celebrations as the patents on various things expire.
Yeah. So. Yeah, but it's so rare that a patent expires because they just keep extending the time frame that the patent applies for.
I thought that was copyright. I haven't seen them actually extending patents that much. I've seen them patenting things.
I think you're actually right on that. My mistake.
I know, like, medicines, a lot of times they'll find a new use for it and repatent it.
Mm-hmm. How convenient.
So, you know, there's that. But and of course that extends the patent for however long the patent's good for. But it's not. I don't think they're actually extending the existing patent. They're leaving the old one expire and getting a new one.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I was definitely thinking of copyright.
Yeah, because copyright's the one where at this point it's life of the author plus the life of the son. So
pretty much.
And by son, I mean the big glow. I mean the day star. I don't mean. I mean okay. Soul, not somebody's child.
The term of a design patent is 14 years, measuring from the date the patent is granted. It's different from a utility patent, which is typically 20 years, and it's measured from the application priority filing date. I don't know what the difference is.
Like, 20 years on the outside is I'm okay with. You know, like, a guy, if he comes up with a good idea and he patents it, odds are he should be able to get the majority of his money out of that 20 years time frame.
Well, the problem with the patents on software is that they're not, the patent office isn't following their own rules. They're granting patents on pretty much everything, you know, and it's only supposed to be on innovative or, you know, unique, non-obvious things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of the things that are getting patented software-wise are very obvious to anybody who does the work, but you know, and they actually advise now, don't look to see if you're violating patents, because if you are and you knew you were, the punishment is worse. And since you probably are, it's not worth looking.
Right.
So it's a joke. So I'm kind of hoping this is an example. So did you have something there, Big, or did I step on you?
No.
Okay. Next one up is from NBC Los Angeles. A Southern California school district is starting a new academic year paying close attention to what its students are saying online. The social media eavesdropping program started last year as a pilot project in three schools in the Glendale United School District. The district superintendent, Dr. Richard Sheehan, said it worked so well it's now expanding to all middle school and high schools in the district. With modern technology, unfortunately, we have to try and stay a step ahead of the kids, Dr. Richard Sheehan said. We're not trying to hide anything because the whole point is student safety. Yeah, uh-huh. Sure it is. Glendale United School Board approved spending $40,000 to hire the Hermosa Beach company GeoListening to monitor students' public posts on websites like Twitter and Instagram. They're on the lookout for things like cyberbullying and suicidal tendencies.
Wow.
Because you never get any of that out of high school students on a regular basis. The program was instituted after Drew Ferraro, a 15-year-old student at the Crescenta Valley High School, jumped to his death from the roof of the school last year. The superintendent says that he believes the eavesdropping program has helped save other kids from trouble by intervening early when disturbing posts were made. But some students are not happy about it. I think it's a bad idea because everybody deserves their privacy, said Crescenta Valley High School student Matilda Sidney, who has no privacy now because her name has been published in a newspaper. The 14-year-old Sidney is among the students at Crescenta High Valley High School who don't want school officials eavesdropping on their internet activities. Some parents support the idea. I think it can nip it in the bud if somebody's being attacked or something negative is being said about a student, Felicia Collins said. Some students started a Facebook page called Remove Your School, instructing students to remove the name of their school so their posts can't be tracked. That's not how they're going to do it. They're going to start with a database of names provided by the school. If you think it's a problem, just put your posts on private so nobody else can see them besides your friends, said student Michael. I should point that out, that this is only getting... they're saying it's not a privacy violation because it's only getting their public posts, which is true.
Yep. You know, I just feel like I should interject here. If you're posting things publicly, I think anybody should have the right to go and scrape that public information because it's public.
That's true. I'm just not sure I'm not sure a school district should be spending $40,000 to do it.
No, I'll definitely agree with you there.
I can think of better uses for that money, like, you know, actually paying a teacher. That could be handy. It seems silly to me that the school is watching what people post on Facebook and Twitter. And you know that it's not just cyberbullying and people who have suicidal tendencies. And not to mention the false positive rate on that's going to be through the fucking roof. They're going to be watching for anybody says anything bad about his teacher, or, you know, how many idiots go on Facebook and post, you know, hey, I'm high on pot, or, you know, something like that. You know, we've already had the school that trying to discipline somebody by taking their picture through their laptop when, you know, they thought they were doing drugs. Remember the whole debacle with the school issued laptops and them taking pictures through the webcam? Yeah, the whole thing that started all that was they tried to get that kid in trouble for doing drugs at home. So, I don't... This seems like a poor use of resources, if nothing else.
You know, like, the problem with these sorts of programs that you institute is that, you know, like, sure, they've got the best intentions in mind. You know, the people who put it up, they want to save lives. And, you know, odds are it probably will... detect some situations where somebody is being pushed to the edge of suicide. And, you know, it may even end up saving them. But these types of programs end up getting misused. They always do. Because people are running it, and people cannot be trusted.
And I have an example of that in one of the later stories, so don't worry about it.
Alrighty.
In my opinion, school intervention should stop at the property line. If they want to have extracurricular outside of school activities, fine. But should they be scraping information on their students to build more detailed profiles on them? No. This is fucked up.
You know, and yeah, it's really unfortunate because that's definitely not the case. I once got suspended for a week from school for throwing a snowball at a kid that was like 4 or 5 years older than me. While walking home from school, we were like a good couple of miles away from the school property, but because we were on our way home from school, it was still technically under their jurisdiction, so I got suspended for throwing a snowball off of school property.
Damn.
Yeah.
I know a guy who had to change schools because he sent a NetWare network message from one lab machine to another.
Yep, been there.
He had to actually change schools because the teacher he insulted was so technology illiterate that she just lost her fucking mind.
Wow.
So, yeah, she got him. I mean, yeah, it was bad. 'Cause the funniest part was if anybody doesn't remember NetWare messages, it's like a Windows 3.1 thing. It would pop up a box, just a little message box, with whatever was on the screen and an OK button. You know, just to acknowledge the message, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the joke was, you know, to do stupid stuff like press OK if you are gay Well, the only button on there is okay. So he sent that to the wrong workstation. It popped up on the teacher's workstation. And whoops.
Yeah.
I don't think he should have been expelled for that, though. But that was actually on school property, on school equipment. So not quite the same argument, but still hilarious. All right, next one up is from the Hollywood Reporter. A federal judge has handed down a huge ruling determining that Hot File is liable for copyright infringement. The lawsuit led by the MPAA on behalf of its member studios was a path-breaking and controversial one when it was filed in February 2011. It represented an attempt to strike against the burgeoning popularity of cyber lockers. The particular one in question was alleged to be storing thousands of copyrighted movies and television shows. During the lawsuit, Hot File was charged with enabling copyright infringement on a mind-boggling scale and deemed more egregious than Napster, Grokster, and LimeWire and indistinguishable from Mega Upload. Of course, Mega Upload never actually got a trial. They were shut down illegally. What made this case one to watch was from a legal standpoint was the argument that Hotfile, one of the top 100 traffic sites in the world, was that it had safe, or Hotfile claimed it had safe harbor from copyright liability and has no vicarious liability for what its users were doing. The dispute gave U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams an opportunity to address the kinds of questions that have come up in Supreme Court's Grokster decision, as well as Viacom's dispute with YouTube and Universal Music's dispute with Vio. Namely, what kind of knowledge and control is necessary before an internet service provider has a legal duty to clean up copyright infringements on a network? Unfortunately, the ruling hasn't been made public and is pending redaction. And the website says it'll probably get released in 2 weeks. The MPAA has put out a statement basically cheering and, you know, hooting and hollering. And it's suspected that the only reason the MPAA went after Hot File as opposed to any others is because they were actually ran out of the United States.
Yeah.
So, I just love the comparison that it's no different from Mega Upload, you know, the one that was illegally shut down with no proof or trial or jurisprudence.
pro tip to pretty much anyone out there, don't trust any service based in the United States.
Here's one even better. Don't trust public file sharing sites like this.
Fair enough.
Don't trust anyone.
Especially services.
Especially
in the
us.
US.
My God.
Yeah, don't trust us. We suck.
All right. Next one up is from MercuryNews.com. San Jose police, under file for interactions with the public that have turned violent, on Friday launched a pilot project equipping officers with head-mounted cameras to record contact with civilians. Officers will activate the cameras about the size of a Bluetooth device and attached by a headband over above the ear every time they respond or make contact with a person. So what if they suspect them of not being human? At the end of the officer shift, the recording will be downloaded to a central server. Chief Rob Davis said the devices, to be tested by 18 patrol officers, are a technological advantage comparable to the advent of police cars, two-way radios, and the 911 emergency system. San Jose is the first major U.S. city to try out the devices, known as Axon. Although officers are already bearing vests, weapons, and radios, most of them are welcome adding a camera to record their actions, Davis said. In addition, he said, we're making it so it has cachet. A leading critic of the department welcomed the cameras as a tool to provide useful evidence, but dismissed their significance as a solution to rocky police community relations. The Axon project is unfortunately a positive thing right now because the level of distrust is so high, said Raj Jayadev, director of the community organization Silicon Valley Debug. But it doesn't address the more fundamental problem, that what stereotypes police may carry when they see people of color on the street and assumptions about character. So his big beef is he says the police are racist. The cost of the trial is being shouldered by maker Taser International of Scottsdale, Arizona. But if the trial leads to full-fledged use, equipping the entire 1,400 officer department will be extensive. At $1,700 per kit and $99 per officer monthly fee, the system could cost...
Nice.
Wow. $2,888 per officer in the first year, or $4 million for cameras.
Wow.
I don't you okay. could build the system cheaper than that. The cameras themselves probably are pretty pricey, though, because I didn't copy the picture in, obviously, but the picture of these things, it looks kind of cyberpunk. It's pretty neat.
Just get them all one of those, you know, those tiny GoPros that you can strap onto your helmet. What are those, like a couple $100? And there's no fucking monthly fee. What the hell is that all about?
It's for processing the server and going through all the data. The big problem I have with this, here's the paragraph that explains it. The kit includes a camera, a control piece, and a computer that will hang from the belt. In the pilot project, officers have been directed to switch on the camera as they are about to contact a civilian. The cameras, equipped with an audio recorder, align with the officer's vision and can later be switched to standby mode. Afterwards, the officer can switch the camera to buffer mode, where it still records limited segments of video and non-record mode. The officer may review the tape at any time, but it may not be erased. At the end of the shift, the device's memory is downloaded into a central server. So, Davis said commanders will regularly review the tapes to evaluate the system and gather information about what could help assess police priorities and procedures. Officers, he said, welcome the devices. Actually, I'm sure a lot of them did. But, if nothing else, just because, see, she was drunk. I wasn't being a dick. She was drunk. The thing is, the big problem with these, the officer has to turn them on. So if you have a case of really bad police abuse, I forgot to turn on the camera. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing with the dash cams, right? They just make sure that the dash cam is pointing in such a way that if they're going to abuse something, that it's not on the camera. You know, how many videos are out there of the, you know, where they take the dog and the dog doesn't alert until they're at the front of the car where the camera's blocking them. Mm-hmm. Or the car is blocking the camera, I should say.
Yeah.
There's plenty of those floating around. So I like the camera idea. I think it's a good one, honestly.
It is.
I don't think it's going to solve your problems of, again, what comes back to a people problem of the officer has to turn the camera on.
Yeah. You know, even if they didn't have to turn it on, it was recording 24/7, it wouldn't make any the reason why I would support this is for officer accountability. And, you know,
it's officer protection.
Oh, yeah. But, the reason why I personally would want it is for accountability. But the problem is, even if they had footage, they're not going to be held accountable. Like, there's been time and time again where there is mountains of evidence against an officer on multiple occasions where they're showing
vacation.
Yeah. And you know, like, where it's like gross abuse of power and like full on like abusing individuals and stuff like that. And nothing happened to them. You know, they get a paid vacation and maybe they'll get like, you know, and maybe as their punishment, they'll get like an unpaid month suspension or something like that. Even if they're like full on breaking the law. Nobody does anything. You know, it's this whole like boys club. We got to protect our own. And you know, I can understand it to an extent because there are a ton of people out there who are constantly just totally anti-police and will like scream rape at the drop of a hat, sort of thing. Not technically rape, but you know what I mean.
But you want to have some fun? Go look up the videos of what are they called? The open carry crowd, where they obviously have a script where they're walking around with a visible weapon, and they've got a buddy there with a camera trying to film the cop because they're trying to catch the cop, you know, violating their Second Amendment rights.
Yeah.
And some of the videos are fucking hilarious because it's obvious the people are trying to rile up the police and they've got a loaded weapon. That seems like a fantastic combination, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like let's try to piss off people who are regularly armed and properly trained in using their firearms by swinging around loaded firearms. But I believe in gun rights, but I think these guys are asking for trouble. So I kind of like this idea because I think it helps protect the police against abuse as much as it does the civilians. I don't think it's going to do that much for police abuse, but I also honestly believe that it's a small population of police that do abuse. I think most of the ones I've ran into were fine. I've only really ran into one true asshole cop.
Yeah, but that whole argument saying, oh yeah, well, you know, it's a small percentage of the police force, so it's okay.
But it's enough to fuck their entire reputation.
No, because It's the entire rest of the police force that protects them. Therefore, they are guilty just as badly as that one person because they're allowing them to make those actions. So even though they might be like the nicest people in the world, when they see another officer abusing their power, they don't do anything about it. And to me, that's almost as bad.
It can be. I'm not going to disagree with that. I mean, I have seen cops step in and stop other cops from overdoing it.
Yep. And
that might be a regional thing, too.
Oh, yeah. No, like, don't get me wrong. There's people all over the place that do the right thing. But it still happens, and it's allowed to happen. And to me, that's not acceptable.
Well, cameras aren't going to stop that. That's my point. Is I think the cameras are good, but they're not going to be they're not perfect.
No, it's a systemic issue, and that needs to be addressed. And cameras aren't going to fix it.
Go ahead, Big. I heard you trying to jump in there.
I'm going to say that not only do these videos need to be recorded and audited by the police, they need to be audited by a third party.
Fuck, just public them. Make the police officer version of YouTube and just upload them.
Yep, upload it and. The more eyes that are on this, and okay, let's say we're in some big protest, and all the cops forgot to record. There's going to be other cameras. Most situations where there's going to be violent police brutality, there's probably going to be other cameras watching the police as well.
More and more of that's coming up. I mean, it's like the guy who was just casually walking by and pepper spraying protesters.
Mm-hmm.
Think that guy realized he was on camera? I bet he does now.
And with Google Glass and Vizio's making one and Vimeo, other companies are actually making these eye recording glass things, it's going to be more ubiquitous.
I think that's a good thing, at least when it comes to law enforcement. Video is awesome.
The more eyes on the police, the better.
Well, on both sides, actually. When I had jury duty, they had video of the guy sitting in the cop car, basically spilling his guts. And it's like, it wasn't even a question because they had him on tape. So, and I know video can be altered, but, it's kind of obvious when they do it usually. I think the more video, the better, especially with law enforcement.
Yeah.
On both sides. So, hell. If you set it up properly, usually the video doesn't lie. It can lie. There's an entire industry in Hollywood that does that, but I don't know. Anyways, next up is from the independent.co.uk. Staff working at the U.S. National Security Agency, the intelligence body, revealed that, this thing references Snowden a lot just for SEO. Use surveillance technology to the NSA used surveillance technology to keep tabs on their spouses, the agency said. It said on Friday that the number of its analysts knowingly and deliberately exceeding its surveillance authority on occasion over the past 10 years and that those involved were disciplined. Yeah, sure they were. Very rare instances of willful violations of the NSA authorities have been found, the agency said in a statement. The Daily Telegraph reports that an employee had even had a code name for the practice of gathering intelligence on their partners, Love Int.
Double plus good.
Danielle Feinstein, a U.S. senator, Dianne Feinstein. And learn to read, Morps, right? A U.S. senator who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee reported that the NSA told her committee that a number of isolated cases that occurred roughly once a year for the last decade, it was made clear that the spying was carried out when a spouse or partner was outside the U.S. Ms. Feinstein, a Democrat from California, said on Friday, these incidents in most instances did not involve an American's information. I have been informed by the NSA that disciplinary action has been taken, and I am reviewing each of these incidents in detail, she added. The AP reports that one employee was disciplined for using the NSA resources to track former spouse. In an interview with reporters last week, the agency's director of compliance, John DeLong, said abuses are all taken very seriously. So, the whole story we were talking about, the school watching people's Facebook? Well, now we've got documentation that the NSA was abusing. And we all knew they were, but the whole PRISM thing, they're using it to keep tabs on boyfriends, girlfriends, spouses.
And you know, the funny thing about this is the only reason that they know about people doing this is because it's self-reported it. So just imagine, just think about this for a second. The number of people who, you know, would abuse something like this. And then think of the percentage of those people who would abuse it that would actually self-report their abuse. You know, we're talking like single-digit percentages here.
Once a year is what they think it was. You think it was that low? I don't think it was that low.
I can pretty much guarantee you, if you sit somebody down in front of a computer that has full access to basically anything that anybody has done on the internet for the last, like, let's say 5 years or something like that, they are going to abuse the fuck out of it. I would. You know, if you sat me down in front of a computer and, you know, I was able to look at all that information, you betcha.
Talk about your blackmail.
So, people can't be trusted. This is not a good system. I feel like I should point that out.
Yeah. Big, you got anything on that before I go on?
The whole idea of int love makes me double plus feel good about belly feel. I'm trying to learn new speak.
Oh, you are doing an excellent job, my friend.
Double plus good.
Double plus good. Next one up is from Ars Technica. Late last year, we reported on a $20 million class action lawsuit covering people who were unwittingly featured in Facebook's sponsored stories advertisements. User photos were used to endorse products that they had liked without their permission and were often used without their knowledge. Worse still, there was no opt-out. So to summarize, Facebook took people's photos from Facebook and use those photos to do ads for some product that they had clicked the like button on. And a lot of these products are probably the ones like, you know, you had to click on the like button to get through a web page or something like that. So they took these people's photos and used them in an ad, just flat out. A San Francisco federal judge granted a preliminary settlement against the preliminary settlement approval for the case in December 2012. Late Monday evening, the same judge approved a final settlement agreement between the plaintiffs and Facebook, granting each person who actually bothered to file a claim a monetary award of $15. The record leaves no doubt that this settlement was the product of an arm's length negotiation and compromise, Judge Richard Seaborg wrote in the final order. Although the monetary relief to each class member is relatively small and the percentage of class members who submitted claims is limited, the settlement as a whole provides fair, reasonable, and adequate relief to the class in light of the circumstances, including the low probability that the a sustained better result would be obtained through continued litigation. So,
wow.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just gonna stop that's reading there.
A fair compensation. Yeah, $15. That sounds about right. Yeah.
So and at the end of the article, they remind people that, you know, you were giving Facebook these photos,
and you did agree to them using your photos in such a way by agreeing to their terms of service.
So, you know, just, you know, if Facebook only had to pay you $15, just don't be surprised if you get a $15 Facebook credit, because they have a little monetary system on there now for their games. And, yeah, you know, one of your photos shows up in an ad.
You know, the thing about Facebook, like, it's generally a good idea to have a Facebook account, even if it's just for potential employers to check up on, so you need to maintain it to some extent. But, like, there's a reason why you shouldn't be, like, uploading all of the stuff like there. You know, you're constantly hearing about teachers getting fired because they were drinking a beer in a photo or something like that. But the problem with this is the whole tagging system. All it takes is some dumbass to take a picture of you without your knowledge and to tag you in a photo, and that's enough. And then they can go use that photo in their advertisements. It's broken. So broken.
Okay. Of course, we know Big's uploading his photos hoping they get used in advertisements, so.
Please use my dick pics.
God. All right,
there's
next story
way
up.
To
this
make
one
sure nobody goes to your account.
Yep. Next one up is from itworld.com. Psychro sent me this story. An upcoming NASA mission will test a new laser communication system that could one day deliver high-definition 3D video signals from Mars and beyond. The Lunar Laser Communications Demonstration will be part of the agency's Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, LADEE, mission. Oh, really? Who named that? Really? Which is scheduled to launch on September the 6th. The LADEE spacecraft will... I feel like I should be reading this entire article as a leprechaun now. The LADEE spacecraft will orbit the moon and collect information on the lunar atmosphere. I didn't think it, or technically an exosphere, for about 100 days. A laser communications module is built into the satellite. NASA has a need for faster download speeds for data from space, and that grows every day, just like it does for the rest of us at home and also from work, said Don Cornwell, mission manager for the Lunar Laser Communications Demonstration. He was speaking at a televised NASA news conference on Thursday. We'd like to be able to send high-resolution images and movies and even 3D even from satellites that not only orbit the Earth, but also from probes that will go to the moon and beyond. Communicating with radio waves has served us well for the past 50 years, but now we have technology to use light waves to communicate more data. Here's how the system will work. When the satellite is in orbit around the moon and visible from Earth, one of three ground stations will shoot a laser towards its approximate location. The laser beam from Earth will scan a patch of sky and should illuminate the spacecraft at some point. When that happens, the spacecraft will begin transmitting its own laser towards the ground station, and the two will work to lock onto each other, blinding millions of people in the process.
Yes!
I love it.
So it's just going to scan the Earth with the laser, trying to use the one from the ground station as a track. Once that happens, communicate. I just imagine a number of people getting hit with the laser in the eye. I mean, really?
This is how they're going to align the orbital solar arrays. You really don't want to be anywhere close to those
just
ground
stay
stations.
Inside.
Yeah.
Just stay inside.
Be sure to put a lot of Mylar on your roof just to be on the safe side.
Once that happens, communications can begin. The ground stations are at White Sands in New Mexico, a NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory site in Wrightwood, California, and the European Space Agency site in Tenerife, Spain.
Okay, so don't live... Yeah.
Just don't live there. The technology should allow an upstream data rate from Earth to the spacecraft at around 20 megabit per second and much faster downstream rate of 622 megabits per second. Home internet speeds typically run several megabits per second to several tens of megabits per second. That's roughly six times the speed that's currently possible with radio-based transmission, said Cornwall. As a bonus, the laser communications equipment also weighs half that of a radio transmitter and costs about a quarter less, he said. Okay, you know, in truth, this is actually really cool. And lasers work really well in space because there's no atmosphere to refract them.
Oh, yeah.
Just this whole concept of the laser scanning back and forth the sky trying to find each other. Just...
did they mention anywhere what sort of power these lasers are going to have?
I didn't see it in the article, yeah. But I only took bits and pieces of it because it was actually a fairly long article. And it was on IT World, which looked like it was kind of written by Tech Extreme, so I was trying to clean it up a little bit as I went.
Fair enough.
Because it had a lot of bullshit in it. Like, you know, we're communicating with freaking lasers! I'm like, oh, God.
But, yeah. You know, that's pretty good speed that they've got going on there.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that essentially what they're able to do is take a fiber optic transmitter, yeah. Which actually is kind of a laser, put a lens on it and shoot it through space as opposed to using a fiber line.
You know, but what I'm really impressed by is actually just getting that through the atmosphere, because, you know, anybody who's ever tried to bounce a laser through like a large amount of atmosphere finds out very quickly that laser beam, like, just like a handheld laser. You point that at something, you know, even like a mile or two away, you're looking at a dot that's like, you know, a couple of feet across. And that, yes, some of that is due to the lens, but a lot of that is just due to, like, diffraction through the atmosphere. So you actually have to use a ton of, like, mathematics and, like, to actually clean up the signal.
You have to actually aim. You have to get the distance right on your aim, otherwise it just dissipates.
Yeah. And like, there's got to be some sort of active focusing mechanism in there, and I'm sure they even have to take into account like the weather that's going on in the area and all kinds of other stuff like that. Oh, actually, that's a really good point.
Not only that, but targets are moving.
So, okay, going from satellite to satellite, that's fine. Going from satellite to Earth, what if they're clouds?
You get a bad signal.
You can't get a signal through clouds with lasers.
It just draws the bat signal.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a cool idea, and it's great from just pure space transmissions, but I honestly can't see this being all that feasible going through the atmosphere.
I'm just waiting for the lawsuit of the guy who was walking down the street near the station, you know, blinded and hit by a car. I mean... He was blinded from space. I mean, that's going to be in the Weekly World News. You just watch. I mean, right, it'll be fucking Batboy was blinded by the moon lasers. I mean, okay. Next one up is from Ars Technica, and this one's just kind of fun. This week on the Tor email list, Roger Dinkledine? I don't mean to mispronounce this guy's name. I'm just not sure how to say it. The project leader for the well-known anonymity tool pointed out that the number of Tor clients running appears to have doubled since August 19th. They have a graph on there that shows that in less than 1 week, the number of Tor users has shot up to about 1.2 million from about 600,000. And Big just posted in, it would say 1 gigawatt laser to hit the moon.
Yep.
So how big of a laser do you need to write your name on the moon?
10 gigawatts, maybe.
Maybe, okay.
We'll just ask BSV for his.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got a spare. And it's, okay, back to the Tor story. It's not just a fluke in the metrics data. It appears there really are twice as many Tor clients running as before, Dinklin wrote on Tuesday. There's a slight increase, worsening, in the performance measurements, but it's hard to say if that's a real difference. So while there are a bunch of new Tor clients running, it would seem they're not doing much. Anybody know the details? It's easy to speculate. Pirate browser publicity gone overboard. People finally reading about the NSA thing, botnet. But some good solid facts sure would be useful. In the wake of the Edward Snowden news and the NSA revelations, yeah, okay, blah, blah, blah. The author is talking about that. So, you know, others in the Tor list have suggested the spike from Russia as a result of newly passed anti-piracy law. So pretty much the amount of Tor usage has doubled under a week in, you know, the space of about a week. And nobody really seems to know why. Like, you know, they don't know where all these extra clients are coming from. And the joy of Tor is you don't know. You can't know.
It's designed that way.
Yeah, probably.
They probably control most of the exit nodes anyway.
They actually set up many of them, yeah. The German government got caught running several of them a while back, too. I mean, well, Tor was actually originally funded by the Navy, I believe.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's not odd to think that the government's running several of the exit nodes in the first place.
So. Just use the hidden services and you'll be fine.
Probably. Be careful with it. What was it I did? I had a Linux distro a while back that was, you know, it was actually two distros and VMs for running Tor. Just go read their wiki. You don't need to use that distro, but just go back a couple of shows in the Digital Dojo and read up on that wiki, because that wiki had an outstanding write-up of how to use Tor properly. So, let me go find that real quick, because it's going to drive me nuts now, because I can't remember the name of that distro. But it was a fantastic wiki. I mean, it was really good.
He's dying out there, Suave. Let's just...
Yeah, help me out here.
So, 1 gigawatt laser. I wonder what kind of cooling you'd use for that thing. Basically. It's probably where they bring out the helium. The liquid helium. That we're running short of. That's why we need to get to the moon so we can start mining the helium-3 that's
actually,
on the moon.
Actually, I found something out very interesting about the Hoonix. Whole helium thing.
It was Hoonix.
And then we'll fight the space Nazis.
There is no helium shortage.
W-H-O-N-I-X.org. Go read their wiki.
Hoonix.
Also, I have to dispute what Big said. There is no helium shortage. This is a myth. There's tons of helium, it's just that it's not being collected from any gas drilling sites. Second the price starts going up, they'll start collecting it, because it'll be worth their while.
But how will I do party balloons?
Hydrogen!
Oh, that'll end well.
Exactly! Bonus, it explodes.
Hey, can we hydrogenate our beer?
Oh, hey. I hope so.
Anyways, All right, where was I?
Last next meetup.
Yeah, there you go. Last story before a digital dojo. This one is from Extreme Tech. Researchers in Austria have developed a new three-dimensional culture system for growing miniature brains in the lab. They began with a custom blend of human stem cells growing inside a spinning bioreactor and coerced them to assemble into complex structures they call cerebral organoids. After 2 months of growth, these unassuming tenderloins reached their maximum size, one far shy of an actual human brain, but they have persisted 10 months now, and their survival appears indefinite. To begin, the researchers mixed together embryonic stem cells, ultimately derived from fetal tissue, and a smattering of cells known as induced pluripotent stem cells, which are extracted from more refined adult tissue. The was encased in gel, which acted as a mechanical scaffold to provide some structural integrity to the soft tissue. After transferring to the spinning bioreactor, which facilitated nutrient delivery, a continuous sheet of tissue known as a neuroplasmia formed around a fluid cavity just as the development of the vertices of real brains. After a few weeks, specific brain regions such as the cortex and even the retina began to form. The researchers were able to tailor unique cerebral organoids that could be used to investigate particular human diseases. In one set of experiments, they used iPS cells from the skin of a patient with a condition known as
microcephaly.
Thank you. A condition where he's Canadian, I'm American, I'm sorry. Hey,
I can do the scientific names, I cannot do people's names.
Yeah, some of them. A condition where brains fail to fully grow. The resulting organoids had much reduced proliferative capacity as a result of the cells adopting mature forms far too early on, represent of the condition in actual development of the disease. Growing whole organs in the lab is an essential tool to understand how they grow and differentiate or specialize. The heart, for example, has a tough extracellular matrix which can be enzymatically extracted and used as seed structure for stem cells to grow on. The brain, however, is extremely fragile, and growing a full-size organ requires further tweaks to the culture system. A major limitation here with any cultured organ is the lack of blood supply. The researchers attribute the lack of growth after 2 months to the inability of nutrients to diffuse to cells once a critical size has been reached. So they've made these cloned, stem cell-grown human brains about the size of a rat brain, and they're using them to study brain diseases, which is cool. That's a neat use for them. I just want to know when I can buy my brain in a chip so I can get organic computers going on here.
It's neat, but does the brain actually function?
We don't know. How would you hook it up and see? They're just growing a brain in a jar.
This is why we need to develop a working brain-machine interface so we can build fake brains.
Actually, this might be a step towards that, if you think about it.
Yep, this is a good catalyst.
If you could, since they can grow these miniature brains, what if you were to give it a more synthetic scaffolding? Like the way they were growing rat brains on chips a while back?
Yeah.
And you could grow a full brain around, a handful of chips and mess of wire and probably make a cyber brain. Use it like a computer.
Not only that, they can use these fake brains to just determine, the cause for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or whatever. And
yeah, that's
how
what they're actually using it for.
How do you know if it's working? You gotta make an interface for it.
So,
old school serial port right to the brain.
Well, if nothing else, it'd give them good practice on dissecting the damn thing, right?
Yep.
But I gotta say that this is pretty damn awesome.
It's actually kind of creepy. Wouldn't it suck to be the little underdeveloped brain in a jar?
Oh, God.
they're not self-aware.
That brings more ethical questions.
It's not nearly as creepy as the Henrietta, what's her name, Lacks, the woman who died of cancer, and they took her cancer cells and distributed it to labs, and there are now 20 tons of Henrietta's Lacks cells in different scientific laboratories all over the world. There are 11,000 patents involving her cells because they are just everywhere now. It's like the cancer research. It's part of Henrietta.
There's only one response that comes to mind with that. Damn, science, you scary.
Yeah. But so the question is, whose brain, or I guess whose stem cells did this come from?
They took embryonic for a good chunk of it, and then they were using stem cells.
Embryonic, like umbilical cords, or is this like, you know, dead fetus?
It didn't say.
Yeah. But either way, it's totally fucking awesome. And, you know, this is the sort of stuff why I fully support stem cell research. And everybody who's like, oh, stem cells, evil, bad. It just boggles my mind. Like, these types of people should not be allowed access to modern medicine. Because these are the same sorts of people who are against animal testing. And basically all modern medicine is a result of animal testing. You know, we wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for that. So, you know, like, oh, you feel
just,
a little
I
bit
just
of...
I just want to understand. People who disagree with you politically should not be allowed to have modern medicine.
This is not a political issue.
They should not be allowed to live.
This is not a political
issue.
Just making
sure I understand.
You know, like, if you don't agree with the way something's being done, then you don't need to use it. That's fine. That's totally up to you. But, you know, like, this is very important science that's being done. And, you know, sure, it might make people feel a little bit uncomfortable, but nobody's being harmed by it.
Except the aborted fetus.
Well, you know, but they don't know that. That fetus is not aware that it is being harmed.
It's not even that makes it better, then.
Absolutely.
I kind of agree with Suave, though, you know? Let's apply this to more things. If you don't understand how the internet works, you shouldn't be allowed to use it.
You know, it's just like, when I die, I would like to donate my body to science. And you know what? It's probably going to get thrown up on a table, and there's going to be a bunch of med students, like, poking my junk and stuff like that, and, like, giggling at my flab and everything. But you know what? I don't care, because I'm dead.
And then at night, whenever they put your body up, the necrophiliacs will come out.
Also, the anus tattoo is going to be fucking hilarious when they find it.
Oh, you didn't show us that at Gen Con.
Oh, and that killed it. Let's just go on to this. Yo! Hadouken! Oh, that's not racist at all. For Digital Dojo, I was taking a pretty good look at BitMessage. So, I don't know how much you guys know about this one. I didn't really get a good chance to pull it down and play with it just because of the nature of it. I would have needed like three or four other people to pull it down with me, and I couldn't get a hold of anybody in time. So, anyways, BitMessage is a decentralized email-like messaging system. It does encrypt all messages that are sent through it. And the encryption is currently improved, and they're actually asking for an audit on their website. And they're saying not to trust it right now because of, well, their encryption's not proven. But it is odd enough that you could at least consider it out-of-band communications, and since most email's in the clear anyways, I mean, you know, it's probably better than nothing, but I wouldn't go dropping your current email system for this thing just yet. But I guess the kind of easiest way to explain it is it's kind of like running an email server on a BitTorrent swarm. There's no actual server. It's just the swarm, right? It's actually kind of based off Bitcoin. They took a lot of the same concepts of Bitcoin, the decentralization and the proof of work. They actually require a proof of work before you can send a message. So sending a message actually takes like four minutes. And that's partly to cut down on spam and abuse of the system, but it's also because you have to actually generate the crypto before you send the thing out, right? So it supports broadcast messages and decentralized mailing lists. And in their bitmessage.org website's a wiki, and they've got a link to a Crypto Junkie article that explains how to set it up on Windows. And I'm definitely going to be playing around with this thing more. And I like I said, I didn't get a chance to set it up, but I probably will set up a BitMessage mailbox just for G15 feedback. And It's not an instant messenger replacement. I should point that one out right away. This is not real-time communication. This thing is highly modeled after email. And it is associated with Bitcoin because they use the same P2P model, and there's you don't have to trust a server somewhere. So your email address ends up being this BM- some 30 some odd character mess. So you need an address book definitely to manage your friends list because you're not going to remember it. But you can it's decentralized, right? So as long as you remember your passphrase and a serial number from the original one, you can regenerate your account and get all your messages. It doesn't, because there's no server, right? It's kind of sending things out to the BitTorrent swarm, and it discards anything more than 2 days old. So you kind of have to leave it running all the time to really get your messages. You know what I mean? But I don't know. There's a subreddit for it, rbitmessage. They've got a lot of good discussions and arguments going on about the state of it. There's somebody on there who's claimed to have, they've claimed to have done some heavy optimization to the proof of work and apparently are able to send it a lot faster. There's some discussions on there about apparently somebody's managed to get the notification message every time somebody generates a new address. So they were able to, for a little while, spam somebody with a message every time they made a new account. So that raised some questions about it. So the thing's obviously still in beta, but it looks like a lot of fun. So, like I said, I didn't get a chance to actually play with it, so I can't speak too authoritatively on it. But I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think?
It's neat.
And it's definitely out of band, and there's no server involved, which is a nice start. And if the crypto's not quite up to snuff yet, that's easy to fix.
Why aren't they using a proven encryption method? I don't understand because they're
tying it to their proof of work, and it's generated in a different way so that you're not trusting an SSL server or passing keys back and forth. It generates the message based on the recipient, the encryption based on the recipient, which is why your names are these funky key based things. And it's supposed to be the one way encryption, and that stuff's hard. It's asymmetric encryption, and doing that stuff properly is hard. So apparently the client has to try several different methods to decrypt it, and because the math they're using is so different and so untested, they're asking for people to test it, and they're saying not to trust it.
I really like it. I think it's a great idea, but it definitely has a couple of drawbacks that need to be addressed. One is just the time lag between sending your message, and I think you had mentioned that some people were working on that, being able to crunch the numbers fast enough to actually get a message sent out in a timely manner instead of having to wait, 5-10 minutes. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be a lot if you actually want this to be adopted on a large scale.
But that's as much to discourage spammers, because if you're forcing your system to sit there and churn through numbers for a few minutes it can send out a message, for an individual message, it's not that big of a deal. But if you're trying to mass mail people, it becomes a problem.
But even a 30-second delay would be more than enough to discourage spammers, because spammers are dealing with like tens of thousands of emails at a time.
There's not even that many people on BitMessage yet.
Brings me to my second point. It's really cool, but basically, in order for it to be useful at all, you have to convince everybody that you know to switch over to it. And in order for them to switch over to it, they'd have to convince everybody that they know. So it's kind of useful if you have like a small, close-knit group of friends and everybody hops over onto it or something like that. But really, there needs to be a way of giving your email address or your BitMessage address to other people. If I had a BitMessage address, I could give it to just a standard email user, and they could send me a message from, let's say, Gmail.
No, they would have to go set up a BitMessage account themselves. There is a gateway. I haven't played with it yet, but I think it's just, last time I looked at it, unless I read it wrong, which is entirely possible because I was skimming a whole bunch of stuff and I didn't get to play with it, I think it's one way.
Okay.
But there is a BitMessage gateway.
But if it's only one way, it's still kind of a deal breaker, because really, for a communication platform to be so limited in the people you can actually communicate with, it kind of defeats the purpose. So it's really cool. And, you know, it's kind of like the chicken or the egg thing where, you know, people aren't going to use it until there's lots of people on there, and you won't get lots of people on there until lots of people start using it.
It's not one way. You can send and receive regular email through it.
Okay. Well, that totally negates that one point I had then.
Well, I mean, but you know, once you're at a bit message and it's just regular email, well, why bother?
Well, it's really just like, you know, you want secure communication.
Let's pick an example here. This will be helpful. Let's say somebody wants to send Galaxy 15 some information they want us to break, and they can't reveal where they're coming from. Bitmessage is anonymous. It's peer-to-peer.
Right.
So, I mean, granted, it's a messaging system, right? So they can, you know, in the message, tell us whatever. But it's not terribly traceable, and it doesn't keep data past 2 days. So if somebody needed to send us something and we had a bit message thing set up, you know, it would be a way that somebody could be willing to go through the effort of getting on bit message, which is honestly not hard.
Right. And, you know,
you run it from a flash drive.
I totally understand where you're coming from. Like, you know, like if you want to send a secure message, you tell your buddy to go get bit message, and then you can send your secure message. And that's very useful. But, you know, I don't think you'll ever see any sort of wide adoption of it as, like, a replacement for any other sort of communication system unless you can actually have the ability to communicate with everybody. Now, you can communicate with everybody, so that kind of negates that one problem. But, you know, like, you're absolutely right. It's not going to be secure if I'm, like, sending an email to somebody over with a Gmail account or something. But at least you have that option.
Tor and I2P. It's going to be there, and it's going to be there for anybody who's wanting to take advantage of sending, you know, something secured or trying to get, you know, people who are trying to be anti-Prism or defeat Prism. But you know, there's no real logging going on. It doesn't keep data for a very long time. So it kind of defeats the whole they're monitoring your email server thing, because there's no email server, which is exactly what it's designed to defeat.
And just the ability to, you know, send messages out to external sources, I think is it's that's what's going to make it popular. Because, like, right now, I would have no incentive to switch over to it otherwise. But now that I know that, you know, I can actually set up an address on there, I can go and basically use it as an email service. And even if, you know, of course, you know, if my messages go through a gateway somewhere and are no longer encrypted and aren't secure, at least my inbox is secure. You know, my inbox where I've got all my messages stored, or, you know, if I decide to store them or not, that's mine. You know, it's not like having a Gmail account or something like that where everything you've ever done is stored on a server somewhere. That's a pretty big difference.
So, anyways, I plan on playing with this. I will set up a bitmessage address for the station. I'll put it up on the website somewhere so that if somebody wants to send us bitmessages, if, you know, they've got some... I'll be honest, I don't know why you'd want to break anything to Galaxy 15, because we don't exactly have any kind of a record of... doing that kind of stuff, but I'd be willing to. I mean, I'd be willing to disclose stuff if people
send
it
anyway,
email.
So we can get a record.
Yeah, that'd be cool, wouldn't it? The audio version of WikiLeaks, only, you know, a little bit better filtered and not quite as biased. So, yeah, I mean, that could be fun. We'll just call it Big's. We'll just have Big read it out. We'll just have Big do it. Your show would be better for it than mine.
Yeah, probably.
So, anyways, we're at an hour and a half, so it's probably time to wrap this up. Listen to the stream. We are always working on it. I believe Big just recruited another band for us.
Two new. We have Clearside and Volt 9000.
Awesome.
Keep an eye out in the station, the subreddit. I don't know when we're going to have our little block party, but in the next week or two, we will be playing two, maybe a third band.
Awesome.
Awesome. course, Pure Decking every Thursday, Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays, The Missing Dialogues. I think he's still doing them on Tuesdays, although Laura was talking about taking a break. I know a lot of the shows went on break right after Gen Con because everybody had con plague and was just generally tired. So, you know, kind of right off the month of August there because of everything going on. But here next, you know, September, definitely we'll be getting everybody back on track. We skipped Let's Get Drunk last Friday and as opposed to getting the show off a week because it's in every other show, we're just going to wait until the next regular one. So there won't be one tomorrow. There'll be one next week, if that makes sense. Of course, I have nothing on Saturdays. Did I miss any of the shows?
I think that's it.
We did have an interesting discussion at Gen Con. We've kind of decided Galaxy 15 is going to be a distribution platform as opposed to less of a production house. So, you know, if Big wants to come up with a fancy studio name for his shows, nobody's going to be insulted. I mean, Lore kind of already did, so, on Lore stuff, so. Anyways, hit up the Galaxy 15 Radio site, the Twitter handle, the Galaxy 15 Radio Sim on OS Grid, which is looking awesome. I looked in there. We've got these big fake buildings to build backdrop out of, so we're eventually going to be able to wall off the Sim so, you know, you don't just see the ocean. The feedback forum, the subreddit. We have an IRC channel, but I don't think anybody's really in there much anymore. I'm going to add a BitMessage account, but I will probably never read that out on the air because it's 32 letters of gibberish. So I think that's all the promotion stuff. We ought to just pre-record the blurb and just play it at the end of the show as opposed to trying to remember this all the time. I think that's it. Has anybody else got anything before I hit play on this music here? Yeah.